This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, December 7th, 1898, President William McKinley gives a joint address to Congress, sort of State of the Nation speech, and no surprise, he talks about the Spanish-American War, which would soon come to a close. He talked about trade agreements with Germany, talked a little bit about westward expansion. One thing he didn't mention was that less than a month earlier, in Wilmington, North Carolina, a group of the state's white Southern Democrats led a mob of 2,000 white men to overthrow a legitimately elected local government, one that was notably biracial. So look, I'm going to let you listeners in on a secret here. We wanted to do this back in early November when this happened, November 10th. We missed that hook. And so here's our weird hook of McKinley didn't mention it in a speech about a month later. But you know what? Like, that hook actually sort of gets to the big point, which is like, from the beginning, this story seemed to have gotten memory hold and forgotten and has just not been part of the history of this country until maybe a little more recently. But, you know, that is a huge part of this. And, So we've been wanting to do an episode on the Wilmington insurrection, and this is that episode. Thanks to all the people, by the way, who have suggested that we do this very, very interesting and important topic. So here to do that, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
So first, I'm just curious kind of how you characterize this moment. In recent years, you know, we've, I think, mostly in very good ways, brought the sort of language of white supremacy, white terror, coups back into the massacres back into the vernacular. And, you know, but I will also say sometimes I think people embrace those terms a little, you know, there's odd fits or whatever. But to me, this is like the unassailable example where you can just say this was a white supremacist coup on American soil.
Yeah, no question. No question. And it's not dissimilar from other things that we've seen or talked about even on the show, such as Tulsa. But what I think is interesting about this is that instead of looking at the economic power that we talk about with Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or other places around the country, this was about Black political power. Yeah. But it wasn't even about Black power in the way that we think of like a monopoly. This was really about just having Black influence, right? Like not full control, but influence over the politics of this small town in Wilmington, North Carolina. And how the thought of this town having Black influence was terrifying to the white residents that lived there and in the surrounding areas.
I think that's such an important point, because the way that this story is told by the survivors, by the victors, is that this was an attempt to thwart what they called Negro domination, right? That that Wilmington was being overrun with these Black politicians, even though Wilmington, which at the time was a majority Black city, the representation in Wilmington, right? It wasn't majority Black, not by a long stretch, a tiny number of people, just as threatening as the rise of, maybe not just as threatening, but almost as threatening as the rise of these Black office holders, is that they were part of a biracial coalition, that they had made common cause with white populists, big P populists, members of the Populist Party, who had some real economic frustrations and some real disagreements with the white elites in Wilmington, and had joined together with Black Wilmingtonians in order to form this, what they called at the time, a fusionist government that was pretty successful electorally starting in 1894.
Right. And I suppose there's a story there that ties into a larger story of Reconstruction, this little moment of actual biracial democracy. And we get, you know, I mean, do we credit Wilmington prior to this for actually having elections in which some, a smattering of Black people are elected? through through democratic means.
Absolutely. I mean, for we historians complain about this all the time, but it's true. It's Reconstruction is like the least understood and least studied period in American history, wholesale. But it's so representative of a unique moment in which Black people are not only voting, but becoming elected officials in the communities in which they reside and using their own political influence to make changes, to improve their schools, to improve their lives, to make sure that they have a government that works for them. So, you know, none of this is extreme. I also think it's interesting that a lot of these Black elected officials are not just working for Black people, but they're interested in like public schools for all children, like not just Black children. But so much of that narrative, I think, is missing from the conversation. And so much of the hysteria becomes about like this scary Black boogeyman that comes to like take over all white people and ruin their lives. It's absurd how quickly things accelerate from 0 to 10 when it comes to very little progressive change.
Yeah, and it's tied, you know, we're talking about Black political power here, but the overarching threat is this idea of Black independence. There are threats that are going to be made in Wilmington against the Black newspaper and also against the Black middle class in Wilmington, because there is a, you know, by the time that this coup happens in 1898, there are like 65 doctors, lawyers, educators who are Black in Wilmington and who are beginning to create the basis of a Black middle class, a Black professional class. And that economic power combined with political power is the stuff of independence. And that independence, ever since the end of the Civil War, has been the big looming threat for white people in the South.
And so to return to kind of where we started here about what really distinguishes what happened in North Carolina and ultimately in Wilmington is the sort of political spheres in which this happened. And this is why I think it's very safe to call this, you know, a coup as opposed to like a mob or some other language that, you know, which you could also call it that, too. But I mean, what we're talking about here are white Southern Democrats after these elections banding together to systematically roll back rights for Black citizens and then ultimately unseat Black elected officials. It's not just what happened in Wilmington over the course of a few weeks. It's a sort of months-long campaign to plant the seeds of overthrow.
Well, what happens is there's a group called the Red Shirts that go about starting this coup and really terrorizing elected officials. And they go to the Republican mayor, Silas P. Wright, the board alderman, and the police chief, and basically force them to resign at gunpoint. And then the mob installs a new city council that they elect, that was elected the former congressman, Alfred Wardall, to take over as mayor by 4 p.m. that day. So this is like quick and fast. You're going to resign. You're going to resign right now. And matter of fact, we have your replacement here on standby. And by the end of the day, I mean, on Waddell's orders, the new quote-unquote elected mayor basically starts this killing spree, and they kill anywhere between 60 to about 300 Black people and then banish people, basically say don't ever come back at gunpoint. And what I think is also really important about this banishment is that it's not just telling Black people to leave. These are landowners. So people that own hundreds of acres of land that could be considered real wealth for Black people or possible generational wealth for their descendants is now lost to dozens, if not hundreds of people.
Right. And as Kelly suggests, right, this was something that had been in the works for months. This wasn't just a spontaneous uprising. It was an attack on the election of 1898. There were white Democrats who went in and stuffed ballot boxes in some Black areas. The number of votes that went Democratic were more than the number of people who were eligible to vote. And it was a political coup in the truest sense. We are getting rid of the rightfully elected people and we're installing our own people and no one is going to stop us. And I think that's the big thing. Like, nobody stops them. And the makeup of Wilmington changes almost overnight. It goes from being a majority Black city in 1898 to being a majority white city by the turn of the century. So in just a couple of years, these expulsions that Kelly is talking about and the terror and violence that's being used against black people fundamentally remakes the city. And these new office holders come in and they start rewriting all of the laws. This is when Jim Crow law comes into play, and people are systematically disenfranchised. They lose their property, they lose their rights, and it happens so quickly.
Mm. It's also interesting to me that President McKinley knew about this. Like, it wasn't as though he was unaware and someone's like, hey, do you know what's going on? He was warned, he was told, he was briefed. He even meets with the most prominent black person of the 19th and early 20th century, Booker T. Washington, to talk about this. And he basically says that his hands are tied, even though the governor of North Carolina is a Republican at this moment. And for those who don't know, like, the Republicans were still a part of a slowly changing, but demographic that was most receptive to black Americans and black rights and civil rights. And they feel as though they can't do anything about it, because to stop or to quell this massacre or mob, they believe would incur even more violence on behalf of white Southerners, that they would be even more incensed that the federal government stepped in to stop this violence.
I also wonder if part of the sort of non-response from at the federal level was a little bit of, and I think this is one of the reasons this has so many echoes for people now, you know, of just kind of, well, you know, our democracy will hold, you know, at the end of the day, you know, these people were elected and our democracy will withstand. And I think as we've been describing, you know, this stuff is fragile. And in the course of, you know, a lot of people talked about Wilmington during the January, what went down on January 6th, because I think it had so many of those echoes of like, forget these high-minded ideals. What we're talking about is like, if enough people get into the right room at the right time, and as you were saying, Kelly, tell one person to get out of there and bring another person in, like, that's the ball game. And I mean, the echoes are pretty obvious. And frankly, the playbook is pretty resonant.
So during Reconstruction, Ulysses S. Grant, when he's president, he sends in federal troops to stop a lot of these riots and massacres that are taking place all over the South. When Reconstruction ends in 1876, the compromise, or the deal with the devil, is that all these Union troops have to be taken out or removed out of the South. They no longer want to have a federal presence in the South, sort of saying what they can or cannot do. So if McKinley were to send in troops, it would send the message to the South again, like, oh, yeah, you're policing us, you're telling us what to do, you know, this is what we fought to end after Reconstruction. And so that is also another reason why McKinley feels like his hands are tied.
Yeah. But black civil rights always require this federal power in order to
always
back them up.
And so, federal intervention.
Yeah. Right. I also wonder, I mean, just putting it in the context of McKinley at the time is waging this war against Spain, in which he's making the argument that the United States has the right to rule in places like Cuba and the Philippines because the people there are brown and black, right? He's making a white supremacy argument in foreign policy. So not to say that he was like rah-rah to the Wilmington coup. I don't know one way or the other whether he was, but he certainly was of a mindset that didn't necessarily see it as the worst outcome for Wilmington.
For sure.
Yeah.
As we wrap up, you know, the legacy here, I mean, Nikki, you hinted at it, that there was just an immense exodus of black residents from Wilmington, but also from a political structural level, I mean, it is stunning how much power gets grabbed back and it just never gets let go again.
Yeah, look, in 1896, there were more than 125,000 black voters in North Carolina. By 1902, so just 6 years later, there are only about 6,000 black voters left on the books. So from 125,000 to 6,000. And I'm guessing that those 6,000 were not all voting in North Carolina elections in 1902. So there really is not just a coup, but there is a fundamental rewriting of the terms of citizenships and rights for black people that functionally not only disenfranchises, but strips them of the rights of citizenship, and will have that will last for the next 6 to 7 decades.
Yeah. Even more than that, what's what's so mind-boggling to me is that you had a few elected Black officials, but after this moment, you have zero. And you have zero for essentially the next 100 years. Wilmington does not get a Black citizen to serve in public office again until 1972. They don't have a Black elected official from North Carolina until 1992. So even longer than 100 years is someone Black going to Washington. So these have really lasting effects. Yeah. And then, you know, the additional rub is that no one was held accountable. There are no, you know, trials or sort of prosecutions for this crime.
Yeah. And as we've pointed out on the show a number of times, but, you know, this is incredibly recent and living history. I mean, you know, just how do we put it? If you've ever had a conversation with your grandparent about something that happened when they were young, your grandparent had a conversation with their grandparent about the massacre in Wilmington. If you're someone in North Carolina right now, I mean, that is, you know, it's two
someone's
skips away.
Grandparents, grandparent, yeah.
You know, told them firsthand accounts. You know, it's still there. It's still present. Okay. Well, we will leave it there. I'm glad we got to this episode, even through a sort of wonky hook. And again, thanks to everyone who has suggested this. And I'm sure there will be other things from this story to come back to. It is fascinating. We've only scratched the surface. But Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you'll need to join the millions of others who have switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/this day. That's odoo.com/this day. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Radiotopia.